That is what I am.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, and welcome to the library. I'm Bruce Farrar. I'm the Branch Services Administrator, and I was just telling Dr. Wood that means I'm in charge of most of the parking lots in the system, except for this one at this building, which is the responsibility of the main library administrator. Those who want to can see me afterwards, and I'll give you her name. But seriously, folks, on behalf of Mayor Bill Purcell and the members of the Metropolitan Council, and on behalf of our library director, Donna Nicely, and the members of the Metropolitan Library Board, I want to welcome you to the library. I'm delighted you got here and made your way through the exciting traffic patterns and whatnot to get here on time, and that we have such a packed house. I noticed in the information coming out about this that this was about a lot of old people getting sick and living too long. And as a member of the generation that's supposed to make Social Security go bust, I felt a little twinge of guilt, but not enough so that I'm planning to volunteer to check out early. I was also reminded of a plaque which hung in my grandmother's kitchen, and actually my great-grandmother's kitchen in Vermont. And it seemed quite relevant to the topic. It was called Why Worry? And it listed, some of you know this, I think. Okay. It listed a series of questions. And really it said, you only have two things to worry about. You either have your health or you're ill. If you have your health, you have nothing to worry about. If you're ill, you have only two things to worry about. You will get better or you will get worse. If you get better, you have nothing to worry about. If you get worse, you only have two things to worry about. You're either going to live or you're going to die. And if you live, you've got nothing to worry about. And if you die, you've only got two things to worry about. You're either going to heaven or you're going to hell. And if you're going to heaven, you got nothing to worry about. And if you're going to hell, you'd be so darn busy shaking hands with all your friends, you won't have time to worry. I am also delighted to have as our guests and co-hosts Vanderbilt University, because they not only provided the intellectual stimulation that we're about to have, but they also provided lunch, and you can hardly beat that. Let me introduce to you the person who will introduce the introducer to the speaker. Mary Pat Teague, who is the Assistant Director for Community, Neighborhood, and Government Relations for Vanderbilt University. Mary Pat?
Thanks, Bruce. At Vanderbilt, we all know that there's no way to follow and act like Bruce Farrar, and we really don't even try, because he's just tremendous and really appreciate that. But anyway, I'm here today to welcome you on behalf of Vanderbilt University, and particular, I'm Mike Schoenfeld, our Vice Chancellor, who was unavoidably detained on campus today and sends his regrets for not being here. But also before we go on, I do want to say that as we embark on our fifth year of the Thinking Out of the Lunchbox, want to take this moment to thank the public library, who've been a partner that we could not even imagine that would work out as well as it has. When we started, we thought if we had 100 people in a room, it would be a huge success. And for the past 4 years now, it's been a capacity crowd once a month for throughout the academic year, and that's great. And Donna Nicely and Bruce Farrar have really opened up the doors to us here, and we really appreciate that. The other partner who this would never have happened without is David Wood, and I'm always pleased to have an opportunity to introduce David to anyone, because he's tremendous. He's never failed us every month, bringing us outstanding speakers with timely topics, and this month I know we'll not disappoint anyone as well, because Professor Locks is tremendous speaker as well, and often rated one of the most popular professors on the Vanderbilt campus. So it's my pleasure to welcome you and to introduce David Wood. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Pat. And it's true, about just over 5 years ago, I remember sitting down with you guys talking about what we might do at the library, and we were just imagining, you know, getting a couple of dozen people coming along to these things, and this is what happened. I'm just grateful that the room is no bigger. I think we would have filled it. Well, you know that these talks are described as conversations with a philosophical flavor. And under this umbrella kind of description, we've had English professors and engineers and environmentalists. Each time we draw Vanderbilt faculty out of their academic shells and invite them to address wider concerns than their own little discipline. But today we don't need to coax our guest to be philosophical. For he is a philosopher, indeed a very distinguished philosopher, my friend and senior colleague John Locks. And when I say he's distinguished, this is not just polite praise. John holds a PhD in philosophy from Yale, and he's the Centennial Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt. He's had a stellar teaching career. He's had many awards for teaching excellence, Vanderbilt's Alumni Education Award, and he was given the Herbert Schneider Award for Lifetime Contributions to American Philosophy. He's been president of the Society for the Advancement of American Philosophy, president of the C.S. Peirce Society, the Metaphysical Society of America, and he's had over 20 grants from organizations like the American Philosophical Society and the National Endowment for the Humanities. He's a force of nature, really. He's been a consultant to over 100 colleges, universities, and organizations. He's delivered hundreds of lectures to educational institutions and civic groups, churches around the United States, and he's often to be heard on radio and television. He's written over a dozen books, including The Ties of Time, The Relevance of Philosophy to Life, Thinking in the Ruins, Wittgenstein and Santayana, The Cost of Comfort, In Love with Life, A Community of Individuals, and another book on Santayana. And he's working, I think this is still true, on books on immortality and on human natures. It'll be clear from these kind of titles what sort of philosopher John is. He's centrally concerned with the good life, with ethical and practical questions, and with questions about human nature, what kind of creatures are we? Not long ago, he introduced a new college president with the following words. This is what John wrote about this guy. He knows how to help a community recognize its values and embody them. He's a brilliant philosopher, a gifted teacher, an inspiring leader, and above all else, an educator devoted to this precious community of teaching and learning. Education is the last, best hope of mankind. With people like him, the future of education is secure. Well, those are words that John used to describe somebody else. I can't think of a better way of describing John Locks. But there are two final things I want to add. I know I'm just the only thing between you and John Locks, so I won't spend much longer. John is one of the kindest people I've ever met, going to extraordinary lengths to help students in difficulty, generous with his time and his resources. And lastly, I have to say this too, the philosophy department has an extraordinary and lively program of speakers and other activities, almost entirely because of John's amazing talents as a fundraiser. Without him, there'd be much less buzz around our farm. And by the way, if anyone here wants to know how they can help the philosophy department, in big ways or small, John is the man to talk to. But without further ado, I want to introduce John Locks, my colleague and friend, who's going to talk to us today about, what's the exact title? It's
Dying Old as a Social Problem.
Dying Old as a Social Problem, John Locks.
It's a pleasure to be here. Can you hear me in the back? No problem? Good. It's obviously the case that dying old is not a personal problem. It's a solution. You know, imagine the alternative, that is dying young. You don't want to do that. But imagine what happens when large numbers of people get to be old. Very old. We don't, not supposed to use the word, it's anti, it's not PC to say old. It's supposed to be elderly. Well, I'm old enough to be able to say old. Imagine what happens when the indications are that there will be, within the next 30 years, over 10 million people in this country over the age of 85. Over 10 million people. This is a prognostication. We don't know if it's so. There may be 15 million people. I don't know. And if physicians will have their way, there'll be many more. Tremendous thing. It's a wonderful thing. And don't misunderstand me. I think I welcome that. I like the idea that we can live longer so long as we live well. What I don't welcome is living miserably and not being able to ease oneself out of this life. That's what I don't welcome, and that's the problem that I want to talk about. Social problem means it's a problem for you and for me. It's not a problem for me only. Many of you experience this with parents, aging parents. Aging parents who reach a stage where they just don't want to live anymore. Pain is too much. There's no meaning to life. There's no excitement. There's nothing to wake up in the morning for. And if you take that as the paradigm of human life, then life is not worth living. And a lot of people, and you know this, a lot of people have made plans in order to make sure that they don't have to live that way. My mother, who is somewhere in the 90s, we don't know where, we don't discuss it, but it's definitely over 90. Many of her friends already dead. Lots and lots of people who whom she had very few relations with when she was young are now sought out, and because there's got to be some connection with the past. You know what I'm talking about. Some connection with the past. And then the issue is, what happens to me if I become disabled? What happens to me if something horrible takes place and I continue to live? That's what much worse, she says, than just dying quickly. So what am I going to do? Well, she has, I'm convinced, stashes of medicines, which, right? Which when the time comes, she says, she will avail herself of. And I'm convinced that between her and her friends, there's probably more medicine of that kind than Vanderbilt University Hospital has now. And what happens is, believe me, what happens is that this gives her a sense that she's in control of her life. This gives her the sense that somehow I know what I'm going to do when the time comes that I've got to do something. Now, that's okay, but it goes against the laws, it goes against our intuition, it goes against the kind of belief we have in the importance of life, in sustaining life, and our attitude right now is still that everybody can be cured, everybody can have some kind of a meaningful life. Now, I want to challenge that. I want to say that that's just not so. That there are people who, at the far edge of life, very far along, have nothing but pain to look forward to, nothing but maybe a few weeks to go. Maybe they're abandoned, maybe they're in nursing homes. They're in places where life does not flourish. I mean, nursing homes are wonderful places, but you're being tended by strangers. You're detached from your roots. You're not in your home. You're in a tiny room with indifferent folks. Some of them are downright hostile. If you've been to places, you know what I'm talking about. I cannot imagine that that is a life that I would want for myself. I cannot imagine that you would either. It's more that we get in the habit of living, and I can't stand the idea of dying. Well, why? Because I've, lived all these years. Don't quit now. But in fact, it's not clear to me that that it's not better to quit under certain circumstances. Here's what I see. I see our society venerating biological life. And I mean by biological life, somehow the life of the body and only of the body. I'm not saying that we don't like to talk to each other and visit and go to the movies and have a few drinks together and go bowling and do all those things that you like to do. Of course we do. But there's something that makes us pull back when we realize that there's not much of that life possible, but there's still a human body there. We have this sense that the human body is in some sense sacred. I'm not against that so long as you're alive and having a good time. But notice what our habits of internment are. If any friend of you had died recently, person dies, the person is put on exhibit. Right? But I mean by put on exhibit, not the way one a dead person is. I mean, that would be unacceptable. The person is dressed up, usually in new clothes, right? Made up nicely, and people line up, go past the coffin and say, my God, doesn't he look good? And I say, how good can a person look when he's dead? But it's all makeup. It's all makeup. And you say to yourself, why do we do that? What is there? Is there a human being there? No. There's no human being there. There is the material residue of a human being. But if you are a religious person, you can't believe that that's a human being. You've got to believe that what we're dealing with is a soul as a human being. And a soul as a human being is not the same as the body. If you want to use old-fashioned language, philosophers like old-fashioned language, you'll say the soul has fled. The soul has left the body. It's only the body there. It's a gravitating heap. That's all. And nevertheless, we take the attitude of, well, there he is. Witness the language. There he is. No, he isn't there. He isn't there. But we say that there he is. And so this veneration of the biological, of the material, gets in the way of what we all understand is spiritually right. Spiritually, it's right to say that somebody who's in a coma, and by the way, let me tell you, the person who's been in a coma the longest, we love records and statistics in this country. The person who's been in a coma the longest is an individual, a woman who had in her 30s, with two little children, an intruder come into her home. She discovered the person. He hit her in the head. She lost consciousness. And 36 years and 10 months later, she died. 36 years and 10 months later. And nobody had the guts to say, enough. The husband was married, so it would be unseemly to get divorced from somebody, right? Like that. So his life was ruined. The children grew up, and there was mom still in a coma. Persistent vegetative state, they call it. And there she was, and everybody's life was ruined, whereas we could have taken the attitude, look, unplug it. Unplug it is enough. Now, I don't mean unplug it 2 days afterwards. I don't mean unplug it a year after. But when everybody agrees that it is simply impossible, it's impossible for a person like that to come back. Nobody after 5 years in a coma had ever got out of bed, dusted himself off, and say, well, I wonder what they're serving for lunch. Nobody does that. So what is it? I'm trying to ask, what is it that keeps us, that says to us, well, you can't touch that body because it's the body of a human being, but the human being isn't there. So whose body is it? It's nobody's body. It's just a body. Just a body. Well, here's the problem, as I see. It's a problem for all of us, and I don't come to you with a solution. I come to you with a problem that we're struggling with because this is a problem for our society, for our legislation. Right? This is the problem of what to do with large numbers of people who are miserable and don't want to live. Now, the state has an interest in the health and welfare of all citizens. The health and welfare, yes. political estate has an interest also in the life of people. And I welcome that because I want the state to take an interest in my life. If I walk out of here and somebody comes up and tries to hit me in the head and kill me, I want the police there. But I don't want the state, personally don't want the state saying to me, look, you, when the time comes, you don't have a right to dispatch yourself. That sounds awful. Let's say, find peace when I want to find it. The person who sort of took this seriously, and that is Kevorkian, and it was an unseemly way to do it, I agree with you, but that person is now in jail. But what he claims, all he wanted to do really was call attention to this problem that we have, and we do have this problem. Now, what is the problem? The problem is that human life is meaningless without purpose. And it's miserable without hope. Purpose and hope essentially give meaning to life. Purpose and hope. The purpose may be a small one. The hope doesn't have to be huge. There's a wonderful section that I commend to you in Sherwin Nuland's book called How We Die. He's a physician, a surgeon, has done wonderful work, and then he reflects on a lifetime of trying to help people. And what he comes away with is ultimately the last chapter of his book, and he says, never abandon those you love. Never abandon your patients. Never abandon them. Never leave them without hope. Now, don't take this to mean hope. You'll be all right, don't worry. You have nothing to worry about, as we heard. You know, you've got nothing to worry about. That's not the kind of hope we're talking about. I'm talking about hope that comes in different sizes. My mother's hope when she gets up in the morning is that breakfast will taste good, and maybe there's something good on TV too. That's a decent-sized hope. Young people that I teach at Vanderbilt have a very different sense of hope. They hope they make it to medical school and they become famous physicians. That's a hope about that size. My mother's hopes are about that size. But you know, that hope is enough to keep you going that day. The purpose is something that you live for. Not just the hope that you can achieve it, but something that somehow enables you to do what you want to do. No matter how easy it is, it might become difficult. It's not that easy to walk sometimes. It's not that easy for an older person to get around. Hey, I walked well today. My purpose was not to have that defeat me. Not to have that defeat me. That's good enough for a purpose. But what do you do? One more time, what do? When there's no hope and there's no purpose. What do you do when you're basically kept alive on some machinery and you don't have enough consciousness to be able to formulate purposes? You don't have enough executive power in your body to be able to say, hey, I'm going to do something today, whatever little it is, however it is. What do you do then? And no hope and no purpose and no executive power. And we say, you got to live. Now, I remember the 60s. And I bet some of you do too. And if you watch TV, the doctor's name was Dr. Welby. Right? Not Ilby. I could have been called Ilby. Because you don't get to be Welby until you first Ilby. And everybody was cured. Everybody was cured. If you go to the hospital today, just a little sign of how things are changing. You've been to the hospital lately, a loved one has been to the hospital, what's the first thing they do? Do you have a durable power of attorney? Do you have, I'm serious, do you have a living will? And many places say, do you want to be resuscitated? To which the answer is, I'm not dead yet. But what do you want? Now, I noticed that some really advanced version hospitals no longer ask that question. They just assume you don't. It's a hell of an assumption, I must tell you. Now, there will be a time when I will not want to be resuscitated, I'm sure, but I do want to make a decision about that. The first thing is just that. Now, why? Because I think there's slowly growing recognition that we have a problem of a very large number of people not well, who may not want to continue to live. How do we solve that problem? Here's the way in which I'd like to solve it, but it doesn't work. The way I like to solve it is, let's have a society in which there's no one who does not have the love of at least some people. There's no one who somehow lacks caring. That somebody would be there to spend time with that person. Somebody would be there to say, wake up in order to be able to converse with me. Wake up and I'll take care of you. Now, that kind of caring, that sort of concern, that's the ideal. There's no question about that. People don't want to die when somebody loves them. But, look, we've got the nuclear family. The nuclear family is the reality. That means it's one parent working, the other parent working, if there are two parents in the first place. They're kids. The kids get picked up after they have had their schooling and after they have been in the holding bin for a while from schooling, so the parents can actually come and pick them up. Right? So where is there room for the older folks? There's no room. We don't even live in houses which would make room for an older person with a certain level of independence and with somebody there to care for them if caring is needed. Help is needed. So, I mean, are we going to change the nuclear family? Are we going to say, no, we just have to do things differently? No. The solution is to put more institutions in place. Our lives are totally run by institutions, don't you think? We put more institutions in place, and one of those institutions, obviously, is the nursing home. Not a nurturing home, a nursing home. Not the same. Now, you send people to the nursing home almost right off the bat. You strip them of meaning and hope. Almost right up there. And yet, where are you going to send them? There isn't any other place. There aren't any people with the time. Everybody is busy. Nobody wants to look that way, back. And you know, the outcome of this is that children grow up with no sense, our children grow up with no sense of what it means to grow old, how you deal with that, what it means to be ill, unless they've got their little illnesses, but that's not illness. I'm talking about chronic illness. Children grow up not really understanding two-thirds of life. You know, they understand play, and they understand that when you're an adult, you're busy. Right? And all the rest of it is a mystery. And they don't understand what's going on, and they'll never learn until they have to take care of their parents, in which case they will not learn because they put the parents in some kind of a home and say, well, we wash our hands. Remember, we visit you almost every week for about 10 minutes. So we're not going to go that way. We're clearly not going to go and change our means of living, our way of raising families. We're not going to change that. What will we change? I think what we will change, if you let me be a prognosticator, remember that a prognosticator is somebody who actually has a good record in predicting what will happen, and I don't. And therefore, you can disregard what I'm going to say in about a minute. I think what we're going to change is our laws with respect to suicide. Oregon's done it. It's now been upheld. Other states will do it. And it will be done grievously. It'll be done grievously because, you know, if you've got a little money and your children may want some of that money, they'll say, well, do you really need to use it up? I mean, really have to live all this year? You really have to. If you have to, it's okay, but, you know, feel better than that. And you laugh, and I laugh, but it ain't funny. Let me tell you, that makes me very serious very quickly. So I think we're going to change the laws. And I think it's appropriate to change the laws. We've got to ask ourselves, why do we not respect the choices of people who make choices about their lives, how to lead their lives, and how to end their lives? We make them make those choices, and I think we simply have to respect that. Is that going to happen anytime soon? I don't think so. But I think it's clear that it's happening. It's happening in a very unhappy way in Holland. If you follow the Holland experiment, the Dutch experiment, it's some people seem to be dispatched without their really wanting to be dispatched. It takes two physicians. And there may be reasons why physicians would sign on to this, and those reasons may not be good reasons. What I want to avoid at all costs is the idea that people are beginning to talk about, namely, that we have at a certain stage in our lives the duty to die. Now, Governor Lamb of Colorado, he was not the governor at that point anymore, and I don't think he's run for office since then. Some people told me he couldn't be elected dog catcher anywhere at this point, after having said that after a while, people have lived long enough, it's their duty to die. Now, I think that's pretty sick. I don't want a duty to die, but I want to have the right. I want to have the right to say, when the time comes, not when I'm sitting in the chair of a dentist and he's drilling away and the Novocaine wears off, and say, I wish to God I'd be dead. He said, okay. I don't want that, but I do want to have for myself the right to say that under certain circumstances, when it's appropriate, when I'm old enough and sick enough and there's no more hope and there's no more purposes, I'm finished. Hey, it's okay to be finished. No, there's everything that human beings do, it's all right to finish it. And when you're finished, you're finished. And you decide when you're finished. Nobody knows it as well as you do. Nobody knows it as well as I do when the time comes. I hope that's so. So I think changes are coming, folks. They're coming. They'll be upon us. We need to adjust to that. And I think those of you who share my belief that we need this right need to push and say, we want to have that sense of autonomy. We want to have that sense that we can determine who we are, what we do, how long we live, how we die, all of that we want. And I think it's appropriate for us to have that. Thank you very much.
Anytime soon. This amount of energy and vigor. I got a few questions I'd just like to put to you before we open this to the floor. And I guess I'd just like to start out with a sort of general, can I ask you a metaphysical question?
Those are the only good ones.
you talked about too much veneration of the biological as sort of inhibiting people from thinking about helping somebody out of this world if they're just sort of in a vegetative state. And then you talked about the ideal of being a person with hope and with ambition and so on. And I'm wondering whether that isn't also biological. I mean, I'm wondering whether you can sort of stick with the biological and so you have somebody like you and like us who are these creatures full of life, full of promise, full of hope. And I suppose I'm wondering whether you need to think or talk about a soul, whether this is necessary for the way you're thinking about things, or whether you're talking about different ways of being a creature. Do you need that sort of metaphysical support to say that there's a soul in addition to a body, or are there just different ways of, like a vital body and a kind of moribund body?
I think that's a perfectly good way to talk about it. That certainly would be the way in which a more scientifically minded individual would want to talk about it. I'm very much taken with the language of tradition and religion, and that is the language that commits us to certain metaphysical beliefs, but I don't mind those. One of them is that there is a soul. that there's a soul that is intimately involved with the life of the body. I mean, this goes back to the Greek. Plato said that the soul is nothing else but that which animates the body. It's the difference between you stretched out dead as a corpse and you waltzing around with Matilda. The two have the body in common, but in the one case, the body is animated, and the other, and animated, by the way, anima in Latin just means be sold, it's soul. So I just happen to prefer the metaphysics that's old.
So do you take seriously the idea of heaven and hell, or do you think it matters when you're considering the kinds of questions that you've been raising?
No, I profess absolutely no knowledge of heaven or hell, except it's heaven when I see my wife. That I know, but it's not somewhere in the transcendent realm. I know nothing about that, and I don't. It's too easy to think of what the source of such beliefs might be, and thereby to debunk them. I don't. Particularly, do I not believe that there's a hell other than other people, as Sarge said.
Well, let me ask you then. Just post one more question on this. I remember once trying to write something about suicide, and I started reading Kant, the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, and he said that what was wrong with suicide was that you were you didn't own your body, and it wasn't. You know, you could imagine, you know, throwing out your chair if it's yours. You know, you can dispose of it. Or your shoes. But he said not only shouldn't you kill yourself, but you shouldn't even chop your arm off or your finger off. It's not yours to take. And I thought that was an interesting argument, because when you think about your relation to your body, it is weird to think that you own it. I mean your living body are the things that own is the thing that owns other things. How can you own your body? And I thought maybe he's got a point that we don't own our bodies, so we can't stop it or chop it up.
But there's a metaphysical point behind that, namely, you don't own your body because God does.
That's right.
God gave it to you, and thus you have no right to discard it. I think that's bad thinking, because let's suppose that we take seriously the idea that God gave us the bodies. It was a free gift. Does that mean that you can never throw away anything that's a free gift? That would put our houses in awful shape. You know, imagine all the garbage that we collect from bad Christmases. And all of those were freely given, but you can't throw it away. You've got to store it. At some point, you see, if it's given to you, I mean, in fact, the very idea of it being given to you leads to the notion that it's yours at this point. So if it's yours, then you do with it what you responsibly want.
Okay, well, let's get on to the real, I think, the serious social question that you were discussing. And it's the slippery slope argument, that the obvious problem, that if you, say, legalize euthanasia, and it's a question you raised yourself, and it seems to be the most serious one, if you give people the right to either to take their own lives or to get assistance if they might need, in a difficult circumstance, it sounds exactly what we want, and yet we know that, and I'm just rehearsing the Dutch problem that you raised, that this puts people in a very vulnerable position, because after all, it's what does it mean for them to want to do this? Does it just mean that they are willing to sign a piece of paper? In other words, if you give somebody the right to do this for themselves, are they not then, in fact, made vulnerable to anybody who might wish to have this happen, especially when they're feeling a bit sick or weak or whatever? And how do you possibly get around this problem?
Well, you've got to distinguish, first of all, two sorts of situations. One is when a person is pretty much in full possession of his or her powers, but very ill. And the second one is when the person is, as is sometimes said, incompetent, meaning by incompetent, not in a position to make decisions, perhaps because the person is unconscious and irredeemably so. Now, in the case of the unconscious person, it's relatively easy to make these decisions, relatively easy, because you need to have a history and you need to have paperwork that indicates what would be the likely course that this individual would prefer under the circumstances. So we need to go back and look, is there any evidence of conversations or writings that this person left that he or she would not want to be kept biologically alive under these circumstances. So that's, I mean, you can work out the details of that. We've got wonderful lawyers who know exactly how to safeguard us in that regard. It's in some ways easier when you are fully in control of yourself, because you can change your mind. You may have said, I wouldn't want to live under these circumstances, and you have to be asked now, how about now? And the answer may be, and this has happened, the answer may be, get that syringe away from me. I'm living. I'm going to be all right. So you simply have to listen to the person when the moment comes for that decision. And it's particularly important that family members and strangers not have a say in that.
I'm glad you said that, because when we usually we talk about family members, we think of the loving people around you. But then, and obviously they often are loving people around you, but they may not be.
They may not even know what motivates them.
Right.
Like the rest of us, we don't sometimes know what motivates us.
Well, I was fascinated that you started recalling the 60s, John, because I remember a wonderful line, which is that if you could remember the 60s, you weren't there. Actually, I'm not sure what that means. I think it means that you might have been taking so many mind-distorting drugs that you will have no memory of the time. But this is the point.
But you feel good about it.
This is the point at which we get to open the questions to the audience. And what we do is we ask you to just ask your questions, and John's going to make some notes, and when he's got more than he can handle, we will ask him to respond to them all at the end. Okay.
I come from a family where a sister-in-law was paralyzed for 8.5 years. She asked to die 3 times, but they would not do it. And you made reference to laws, and I recall recently the Terry Schiavo case, where people in Washington, and some that we know quite well, in my personal opinion, made fools of themselves. Now, do you really believe that we can come up with laws that are going to change the attitude toward this? Well, if we do not, I think we're in serious trouble for those of us who will be over 85 10 years from now.
Okay. We have a... Does this mic work, or does it stop working? Is there another question there? Yeah.
Yes, I'm wondering, I'm in my work, I work with a lot of people who are terminally ill, and a lot of people that end up in nursing homes have chronic illnesses that began when they were able to make decisions for themselves. So my question is, would it be helpful to encourage the medical community to increase spiritual and emotional care when people get sick at a younger age, to help the whole family deal with their illnesses as it comes up, so that we're not at the end of life with chronic illnesses, people are in nursing homes, aren't able to make decisions. If that makes any sense.
It's me.
After living in Japan for 2 years, I've seen old, and other places, I've seen old people render their worship, they're taken care of, they're loved, they're not hived off to these little cells that the Americans put them into. Is it too idealistic to hope that we could perhaps improve this so we're not taking care of such a horrible way?
Well,
Okay, this gentleman over here.
Is this on? Yes. It seems to me that one of the greatest problems we have in this area is dealing with fundamentalist Christians who have the concept, as you talked about, that the body is so important as long as the least bit of life in it. How do we deal with these people?
Well, we may have people here. There's a, what, in the back there? Is that right? Is there a lady at the back? Yes. And then you, sir. Yes. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, I'm here.
Yes. I simply want to challenge your one statement that the nursing home is the only alternative new for your family. There's quite a group of us here from who live in a retirement center. There are several good retirement centers in Nashville which provide a community, supporting community, which is a stage before assisted living and the nursing home. And that is a growing alternative that many people face, and I think an excellent opportunity. I say it's a gift that I've given to my children by moving into a retirement home before I have to move into a nursing home.
Thank you. This gentleman here, and then the gentleman behind, and then the lady behind him. Yes, sir.
We have a tendency in this country to vote with our feet or something like that. And I do believe if they haven't overtaken the homicide rate already, the suicide rate already has. And so I think what has been said before is what we're looking for is something seemly, a legal way to be seemly for folks to realize the preciousness of life and that it, and death being a part of it and allow that to happen. At the same time, my heart is broken with all the youth, 15, 25 years old, just on the whim of, I'm getting away about something. I don't understand that kind of depression, but it seems to me that all ages need a seemliness about what life's about and participate in all of it willingly.
Okay, thank you. There's a gentleman behind you and then a lady behind him. Just, yeah.
In the present medical system, there is a way for doctors to assist a person to die. It's very subtle, and everyone agrees on it, but they'll just say, would you rather not continue the support and withdraw? I think that's going on all the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me in our present healthcare system where we have Medicare, where you really don't ever have to make these decisions because it's always paid for. And if we were in a society that didn't have government health insurance, where you did have some real, people would face these issues with chronic illnesses, I think, a lot earlier and kind of avoid a lot of the suffering and unnecessary surgeries that go on because doctors don't want to be sued and they're going to be paid anyway, whether, they perform the surgery or not.
Okay, I think we got maybe time for two more questions. You got a capacity for two more? Yeah. Yes. Yes, sir.
I come from a fairly long-lived family. I'm less than that. My mother, as yours, is in her 90-somethings. And I wonder, she's now suffering from dementia. and is at the point where she is incapable of forming the intentionality to choose to keep her life. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on how that whole area might be addressed.
Got so many questions here. Is there a lady here? Yes.
I just want to say that I want everybody to take a good look at me, because if I die when I get out of here today, I want you to know whatever happens to my brain, or you run over me, or he hits me, or whatever, if I'm not with it, I'm going to live. I want to live as long as a bear hibernates, a black bear. Because when I was a little child, my brother wouldn't let me ride his truck wagon. I ran off, got in the hole with a black bear, a dirt cave with a black bear, and he'd been asleep all winter. And I woke him up and he went, rah! But he didn't eat me. And I've always thought, when I see people getting ready to die, I wish you could live as long as a black bear can hibernate all winter and then think about it. And that's my story for the day.
Thank you very much. Okay, I've got our last question back here. The rest of you are going to have to talk to John afterwards. Yep.
Lord, I'm going to have to follow that. I'm really fascinated with what you said about the veneration of the biological. And I think probably everyone in this room, there are people who come to the library, are all people who are working to make us pay more attention to our soul, spirit, than just the biological. And I think that we're not seeming to win that, certainly among young people. And so I was wondering what you think we need to be doing more so that we actually are thinking about people's quality of life and what things mean to them, instead of just what is the body doing.
Thank you all very much. John's got 10 minutes to handle all this.
Solve all these problems. In 10 minutes, that's not quite as long as a black bear hibernates, right? I think it's a beautiful idea to hibernate. It's a beautiful way to conceive death. Of course, the answer is we don't know what death is like, but all the literature that I read about it always associates it with sleep. And I guess hibernation is a nice image for that. So I like that. Okay, let's take a very difficult one first. And that is, what do you do with somebody who is who's suffering from dementia, from Alzheimer's? Well, you know, sometimes there's nothing you can do about that, but you should have done something before. I mean, there are lots and lots of things that we do that once you've done it, there's no way of coming back out of it. But you should have had some thoughts as to what might occur. So when you reach the age of 50 or 55 or 60, it's not unreasonable to say, I'm going to make some arrangements for how I am to be treated should I not be in a position to make decisions for myself. That's what I meant by the advanced directives, the living will, and so on. Now, it's one thing, and this makes it difficult, it's one thing to deal with folks who are constantly in pain, suffering, not really there, in the haze of morphine. That's one. The other, an altogether different story, if you're dealing with somebody who is who's in the early stages or even the middle stages of Alzheimer's. Because what you've got with Alzheimer's is moments of lucidity. And we happen to know somebody who says, hey, I'm perfectly lucid, I don't have Alzheimer's. He goes back into it. And at the time that you think that you don't have it, you see, that's the only time you can make a decision, but then you think you don't have it. And so I don't have to make a decision. But it's a very difficult issue. The only way out of that is to decide way ahead of time. All of us decide way ahead of time what we want done. How to deal with fundamentalist Christians? It seems to me that that is the easiest of all, because If there's anything that Christianity teaches on this matter, it is that the body is not the ultimate reality. So anybody who worships the body worships it falsely. It's holding up false gods. I mean, if it's not the soul, and this is why I like that language, if it's not the soul that we're dealing with, if you're a Christian, it's not the soul you're dealing with, I don't know what you're dealing with. So you've got, I mean, it seems to me that Christians have got to come around to a view, which is the traditional Christian view, that it's all ultimately a matter of the health of the soul, and the body just drags along. I like that view, not because I don't like the body, but because it gives me an understanding of what's really important. You call it quality of life, okay? I call it flourishing. That sounds like Aristotle. Quality of life is something very uniquely modern. Soul and health of soul sounds religious. It's good. So I think all we got to do is call attention to what they're supposed to believe, not what they mistakenly believe. Okay. Could we take better care of the old? Of course. The question is, what will it take in terms of major adjustments of social life? What's happened is that the standard in this country now is the two-worker family. So long as the standard is a two-worker family, it's just not possible to make room for that older person or those older people. A friend of ours just converted the upper segment of their house to accommodate the wife's parents, who are really not in terribly bad shape, frequent visits to the hospital, but they're all right. They're not in dementia or anything like that. They came in from Florida, they came to Nashville, and within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, so utterly rendered the lives of these two people miserable, and in the process rendered their own lives so miserable, that all they wanted to do was to get back to Florida, and they did. And when they did, they heaved a sigh of relief, and the younger people who had imported them heaved sighs of relief for weeks, hyperventilating in delight. So it's not that easy. What kind of dislocations of our current ways of doing things would be necessary in order to accommodate a better treatment, family-like treatment of the old? Your guess is as good as mine. It's not going to happen anytime soon. We got it?
Retirement.
Well, that's before you fall seriously ill. Sure, I don't have any problem with that. But what happens when you fall ill?
Well, you're right there.
Okay.
Assisted living attached.
You move
next door.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm not talking about what happens sort of on the way to the stage where you feel you've lived too long. Because obviously when you go to the retirement home, you make new friends. And there's social life there, and that's important. Lots of people can't afford it. Let's focus on that. Lots of people can't afford it. And lots of people, when they fall ill, no longer have the benefits of that community. Let me see if I can. Adolescent suicide, a tragedy. The last thing that I would ever be thought to champion is suicide for the young. Suicide for the young is the result of a terrible mistake. It's nothing but a mistake, because so she jilted me. Okay. I'll find somebody else. She's not the only person in the world. The idea that there's only one person that you could ever marry and be happy with is pretty nuts. It doesn't mean that one isn't particularly right. It just means that there might be others. So I'll find somebody. But it's very difficult to catch them at that moment. Now, what's behind that? I think what's behind that is a failure of the community that sustains us. the community of young people somehow is not quite as adept as at giving support as some of older people are. My wife's been ill, and the amount of support that we have had has been incredible. Young people don't quite always do that, and so the suicide is an easy way out. There are lots of things that we need to do there to stop that. It's a tragic mistake. Yes, we should have seemly ends, whatever seemly means in that context. I think that the end we should have ought to involve a celebration of our lives. You know, not a grief over the fact that we've run our course. Everybody and everything in the world is limited. Everything about human beings is finite. So accept the fact that we go a certain distance, and if we're lucky, we go a long distance. And at the end of it, you say, it was a good run. And you celebrate, and your friends celebrate, and that is so satisfying. And then you're ready to go. And you're ready to go anyway. But without that celebration, you don't have the sense that you belong in the community. And without belonging in the community, life is worthless. Just worthless. Okay. Depression. Now, two views of depression. Lots and lots of people take the attitude that depression fundamentally distorts our view of reality. Some few people, for instance, Schopenhauer, the great, great pessimist of the 19th century, says only depressed people see reality the way it is. Under certain circumstances, I think he is right. Look, if I saw the world in a depressed way, it would be ludicrous. I wouldn't even know how to do that. But my reality is wonderful. But somebody who is suffering from multiple organ failure, has been abandoned by family, is constantly in pain, and then we say, well, he's depressed, and that's why he sees things as being dark. Yeah, you're out of your mind. They are dark. For this person, things really are dark, and his depression at last shows him what it's like. So I don't think that we need to dump on depression and say, hey, you know, if you're depressed, you can't see things the way they are. Let's be sure that you don't get depressed until such time as things are really, really bad. Then you'll see reality the way it is. When do we withdraw support? Are we running out of time? Oops.
We got about a minute.
Okay. Got 1 minute. All right. What I mean, spiritual help early. You bet. That's all I can say on that one. You bet. I think we need spiritual help, and we need experience. Experience means that children see what it's like to get old. There are nasty ways of getting old, and there are dignified ways of getting old. To get old in a dignified way, which means you show the young people how you handle the fact that you can't do things that you used to be able to do. You know what I mean? That instead of complaining about that and moaning and groaning, instead of that, you take that with, you know, like a human being standing up and saying, look at all the things I can't do. No, it's okay. I can do other things. There's always something you can do. Right? Do the things you can. And that's what it means to be dignified. And the children see that, and they'll know. They'll remember when the time comes. The trouble is, they don't have any memories like this because they had no experience. Without experience, we're dead in the water. Thank you very much.